is nowhere.
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is actually part two of starting with episode 623. This is hour one of episode 624. It is part two of the surveillance notes. We're going to pick up on chaos. I think we closed out talking about that last time. And welcome, Jason. You guys just had a hell of a storm come through.
Yeah, that was one banger. Tornadoes, everything. Thankfully, nothing got near us.
My friend in Michigan yesterday got a warning on his phone, and within about 10 minutes, they had 80-mile-an-hour winds. I'm pretty sure that's hurricane force. I think hurricane starts at, what, 70 or 75, something like that? Yeah, we've been having crazy weather all around.
We get storms every year, but it's really early to have had this many already.
Yeah, just located where I am, we're like in a bubble, but what worries me here is the wind, because it just kicks right off the ocean. But anyhow, we should tackle this. I think we're jumping in with chaos. Anything you want to add about the notes, or you want to jump in?
Well, by the time everyone hears this one, they'll have hopefully heard part one. And we're still in the mid-20th century. And just the amount of stuff that has gone on at this point in the timeline is just, in my opinion, over the top crazy.
It is crazy. And, you know, as far as we know, the United States leads the way in these things. It's almost as if World War II was the seed to plant all these organizations, which became one thing or another, which, I mean, now they operate basically like private corporations, many of them.
What I noticed when I was going through all this, that even going back to mid-century of the 20th century, money didn't seem to be much of an object. They just did whatever they wanted with these massive organizations for whatever reason. They wanted the control, they wanted the data, and they got it.
Before we jump in, let's actually talk about that, because I hear this all the time, and I want to make a point here. Money has not mattered at the levels we are addressing for maybe since before the 70s. I know certainly since the 70s. And the reason I know this is because it's made up. Someone taps a keyboard somewhere and money is made. And not only is it made, it's loaned at interest. So more money is generated from the fake money made in the first place. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because I see people doing things like covering Disney. Oh, this new Snow White movie was such a disappointment and they're losing money. It serves them right. They don't care. They don't care one iota how much money they make. What they are doing is putting their program into a film, which the older generations are rejecting, which is clear from the box office. But the older generation is going to go away in the next 20, 30 years. That movie will stand the test of time. It will be remembered by the generation, young generation it was delivered to, and it will do its work through the entirety of that period up through when the older generation leaves. That's actually what's going on, using a movie as an example. When you have money that is based on nothing, that means that the top places in the world not only don't care about money, they could spend a gazillion dollars a day and still never care about money. And I think it's an important thing to remember. What is currently king is data. Data trumps all other things right now. Anyhow, you have anything to add to that?
Well, if you just want to back that up, like I said, just look at what these programs were spending all the way back into the 50s and 60s. And then after that, I mean, the computers got so powerful at that point. Even by the 70s, they were really making everything computerized. The 80s, even more so.
Consider chemtrailing. You know, there would be a bill, right? Fleets of airplanes, presumably all over the world, spraying God knows what, but that cargo must have a cost. They must be paying the crew members on the ones that aren't automated. It's an open check. You know, it just cost is not the concern anymore. These places have not had to worry about money. The people who have to worry about money is us. And this system is designed to make it difficult for the majority of us to get money. It's not even a problem when people get a lot of money, but when you start becoming a millionaire or better, if you're going to keep that, you're going to be approved by the inner circles in most cases. Anyhow, I just think it's critical for people to catch on that money is no object to the people running this show.
So we're picking back up in 1967, and we see the launch of the CIA's Operation Chaos, which was a covert program to monitor domestic dissent that particularly targeted Vietnam War protesters. Operation Chaos was initiated by the CIA under the direction of President Lyndon B. Johnson, who sought intelligence on the growing anti-war movement and its potential ties to foreign influences, most particularly with communist organizations. The program was led by the CIA's counterintelligence staff under James Jesus Angleton and would later expand under director Richard Helms. Its stated goal was to determine whether foreign governments or groups were funding, directing, or influencing domestic dissent, particularly with Vietnam War protests. But its scope quickly grew to include widespread surveillance of American citizens and organizations in direct violation of the CIA's charter, which prohibited domestic intelligence activities. The CIA compiled files on over 300,000 individuals and organizations, which included student activists, anti-war groups like Students for a Democratic Society, civil rights organizations, and even members of Congress. Methods included wiretapping, mail opening, physical surveillance, and the use of informants. CIA agents infiltrated protest groups and would often pose as activists in order to gather intelligence and disrupt activities. This mirrored tactics that were used by the FBI's COINTELPRO program, with which Chaos frequently collaborated. Operation Chaos utilized early computer systems to create a centralized database, which was known as, wait for it, HYDRA, to store and analyze data on individuals and groups. This marked an early use of digital technology in domestic surveillance. The CIA worked closely with the FBI, the NSA through Project Minaret, as well as local police, with them sharing intelligence and coordinating efforts to monitor dissent. This collaboration blurred the lines between foreign and domestic surveillance, which further eroded legal boundaries. As has been so common with these sort of things, Operation Chaos operated in extreme secrecy, with its existence hidden from Congress and the public. Its domestic focus violated the National Security Act of 1947, which restricted the CIA to foreign intelligence, and its methods often lacked judicial oversight, which violated constitutional protections. Operation Chaos intensified through the late 1960s and into the early 1970s, being driven by escalating Vietnam War protests and the broader social unrest of the era, which included civil rights activism and the rise of black nationalist movements. The program was exposed in 1974 by investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, which led to the Rockefeller Commission and Church Committee investigations, which confirmed its illegality and prompted reforms, which included the establishment of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence to oversee intelligence activities.
Which is a bit laughable. There's so many things we could say about this, but the first thing I want to note is, isn't it interesting that we close talking about this? Are you old enough to remember Maxwell Smart, the original 1960s Get Smart, Jason?
I am. Well, it came out before I was born, but I saw it in reruns.
So Chaos was one of the things. So right, I don't remember what year it was. I think it might have started in black and white, but I don't remember. In other words, it's going to be the 60s. But they put Chaos in there. They put the names of the things that they're actually doing. Supposedly, this is running below board. Supposedly, nobody knows about it. Supposedly, later they get caught. And with a name like Rockefeller Commission, sounds a bit like the hens, you know, the foxes in charge of the hen house. But they're looking for dissident groups, and you know the music like I know, Jason. Part of the music becomes the soundtrack for the Vietnam War, like Creedence Clearwater Revival and all these. Every time you see a Vietnam film, you're going to see the music that became the soundtrack for that. At the same time, there's all this music that is supposedly protesting it. But what do you think, Jason? Did they have control of the recording industry at that point? I think we can say they did. We know the Beatles is a construct. And just to put a fine point on it, this is the period of time when drugs are now openly being ported into America to change the culture and the subculture.
Well, in case you don't remember, speaking of control, there were two organizations in Get Smart. Chaos was the bad guys.
Right.
But do you remember what the good guys were called? They were called Control.
Ah, there it is. I had to think about it. Now, every time I think about it, all I remember is his heel phone. You know, the phone he had in the heel of his shoe?
Yep. But as far as the music is concerned, we're in the era now where I think they really, I don't know how you want to put it, but got the hang of it or got their players in place. Because we're now talking about the late 1960s is the Laurel Canyon era. So we went from the Beatniks in the 50s and early 60s, which moved into folk music, which then turned into folk rock, and then into full-blown rock, with the psychedelic stuff being a short time in there in the very end of the 60s, and then into full-blown rock and into metal. So yes, at this point is when they must have really figured out what it is they want to do with it.
I'll say a thing that's blunt to most people's ear. The only reason we got rock and roll, the electrified version Jason's referring to, is because it was a psychological operation to lower minds, to break the family unit, to introduce drugs, and to get people hooked on music that was repetitive. And they were going to use the repetitive nature of this style of music where there's not movements and all this change. It's just all based on repetitive song building. They're going to program people through it. And my conversations with Fortune, and you're aware of the Coleman work, if you buy into the Coleman work, which I do, and part of the reason I do is because people like Fortune knew a thing or two that are completely separate from that. The entirety for the foundation of modern music was to psychologically engineer a population and introduce sex and drugs.
So let's quote Bob Dylan here. Play it loud.
Well, there it is. I haven't gone and seen the movie. I doubt I will, but there's a new movie out on Dylan. But I do remember the kerfuffle when Bob Dylan plugged in his electric guitar. So let's ask the question. Did he plug in his electric guitar because he wanted to, or did he plug in his electric guitar because he was directed to? From my point of view, he was directed to. From my point of view, he went on 60 Minutes and he told you the truth. I've been controlled from the beginning. I signed a contract to get where I am. And to this day, I am not retiring. I'm 110 years old, but I'm still working, trying to hold up my end of that contract. And I think that tells us all we need to know.
And he's still on tour this year.
There you go. He'll never stop. I think he thinks he's going to die if he stops. That's what I think.
I actually finally saw the movie and it's pretty good.
Is it?
Yeah, really good cinematography. It's great as long as you don't think it's a historical reenactment beat for beat. A lot of stuff was condensed, but you definitely get the general idea of how things went down with him in his early days.
So you feel like it's a decent shake on the history and not just another one of these films to program a false history into the mindset?
Well, it's supporting the mainstream history, but it's kind of cool to see it unfolding before you, showing like how it went from the coffee house, beatnik, folksy stuff into the electric rock music kind of thing. You see it play out throughout the movie because it takes place over a couple of years. They also get the whole nuclear scare in there because October 1962 is when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened, and they show Joan Baez freaking out and running out of her apartment. People are freaking out through New York and trying to get out, which this didn't actually happen. I tried to fact check that, and apparently they were just exaggerating it for the movie. And she runs across the street into a coffee house, and there's Bob Dylan down in the coffee house playing Masters of War.
Yeah, you know, funny you brought up Joan Baez. In my view, she's controlled opposition. I think it might have been at Woodstock, some big gathering when she's in front of a mic. I think she's talking about her supposed husband or fiance or something being in trouble with the IRS. This is all controlled, in my view. And we've covered people like Gloria Steinem, who launched the Women's Lib movement. All these early rock and rollers that got so big, they were all backed and they all had a mission to do. And by the way, in that movie, Silver Lake, that people, I think, completely missed the point. There is so much in that movie, and I think people absolutely glommed on to the obvious but wrong conclusions. The one part where the guy's saying, I'm the guy who wrote your grandparents' music. When you think about it, you're looking at a dude that looks like he's 100, but he starts by saying, I wrote all the music to your generation, to someone in their 20s or 30s. Then he goes on to say, I wrote all the music for your parents' generation. Then he goes on to say, I wrote the music for your grandparents. Then he goes on to say things like, I invented the wedding march or something like that. Just going further back. And I think they're giving you an honest slice. I don't think there's any time that we can look back at where the recording industry at the top level of what was going to go out on the radios wasn't a controlled process. And that's where I stand.
Now, that movie kind of takes a jab at the whole decades thing, because he's going from playing Crazy Train. He's sitting at the piano, does Ozzy, does Crazy Train. And then the main character is a big Nirvana fan. He starts playing Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Right.
And the guy's got what's supposed to be one of Kurt Cobain's well-known guitars there in the room with him, implying that the whole thing was fabricated.
Well, he goes so far as to say he knows the kid's worshiping the supposed Kurt Cobain guitar and loves him and recognizes that's what mattered to him. He says as much. And then he looks at him and says that song was not written on a distorted guitar. It was written on this piano. Critical things that are put in front of us. And by the way, just if anyone gives a damn, I've thought about breaking that movie down, but the amount of work, I don't want to have to go in and break the codes, but the overall message gets critically to the center of things, all the way down to the tunnels under the city. But for anyone who watches it, the main character is almost certainly the dog killer. He's also a murderer, just to frame it up if you go to see it. But anyhow, we're kind of getting off track here.
The big thing with that movie is just watch the piano scene. It's available on YouTube. But on June 19th, 1968, the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act is signed into law by President Lyndon B. Johnson. Title III of this act, often called the Wiretap Act, formalized rules for wiretapping and electronic surveillance, mandating that law enforcement must obtain judicial warrants based on probable cause for domestic surveillance, thereby codifying privacy protections in response to Supreme Court decisions like the previously mentioned Katz versus the United States in 1967. However, the act also included significant national security exceptions, allowing warrantless surveillance in cases that were deemed to involve national security, thus preserving a loophole for unchecked government surveillance. The act also prohibited private individuals from conducting wiretapping or electronic surveillance, except in limited circumstances, such as recording with one-party consent, and imposed criminal penalties for violations. The Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act was hailed as a landmark piece of legislation for codifying privacy protections in response to Katz, and was said to address public concerns about unchecked wiretapping by law enforcement. But of course, it actually didn't.
Yeah, it's beyond laughable. And how do we know that? We know that because of what happened with cell phones. They used to, in the 60s and 70s, in almost every police drama, make sure people were read their rights, make sure there was a warrant for the wiretap, show people hanging up the phones to follow the rules, all the things they did, and it's all poppycock. And we know this because all of a sudden when cell phones came, everything was off the table. They've been collecting it from the word go. And so if there was any concern about invading privacy, I don't think it would have went that way. But let's even take a closer look. Who are we talking about? Lyndon B. Johnson. How did Lyndon B. Johnson get the presidency? Not by a fake vote. He got it by being implicated in the JFK psychological operation. So he's in up to his throat. I'm just saying, none of this comes clean. I think they have been tapping at will at the highest levels since forever.
The social and political turmoil of the 1960s spills over into the 1970s. By June 17, 1972, the Watergate scandal begins to unravel, which revealed such things as President Richard M. Nixon's enemies list, which was a secret list that was compiled by Nixon administration officials, primarily White House counsel John Dean, to identify and target individuals and organizations that were perceived as political adversaries. What was uncovered was the misuse of surveillance tools, which included tax audits and wiretaps, being wielded against those political opponents. This scandal, which ultimately led to Nixon's resignation in 1974, highlighted the extent to which the Nixon administration had been weaponizing federal agencies such as the FBI, IRS, and CIA for political purposes, blurring the lines between national security and partisan politics. The exposure of these abuses during the Watergate investigations, particularly through congressional hearings and media reporting, underscored the dangers of unchecked surveillance power and contribute to significant reforms being aimed at curbing the surveillance state. With that being said, it is also revealed the surveillance state's resilience as similar practices persisted in subsequent decades under new justifications.
Or just plain being done in the basement where no one can see it. But I mean, let's be real here. Within about 15 years of the last day of World War II, a crazy thing happens that most people aren't old enough to consider. My parents were pretty proud to be Americans, though near the end of their life, they were starting to feel very uneasy about everything. My grandparents, on the other hand, were all in, so proud of what they had accomplished, what America had become in their lifetime. Within 15 years of the end of World War II, there was an absolute split between how we thought about the so-called federal government and the presidency and what it is now. Before JFK, there were scruples, there were rules, there were ethics, there were expectations. After Nixon, that had been already eroded to a point where it's only obvious that it's going to lead where we are today. And I don't think it's any accident. I think it was done intentionally. In the same way Vietnam was run the way it was run, we had never lost at anything before that. Just one thing after another was done to destabilize the mighty America that could do no wrong. And it worked fast. I'm saying within 15 years of the last day of World War II, we had already been irrevocably destabilized. And in how we thought about this place was, well, to borrow the word, put into chaos.
On December 31st, 1974, the Privacy Act is signed into law by President Gerald Ford. The act is enacted in the wake of the Watergate scandal and the revelations of widespread surveillance by federal agencies, aiming to regulate how the government collects, maintains, uses, and disseminates personal information about individuals. While it established important safeguards and transparency measures, it did not halt federal data collection, instead being said to expose and formalize the scale of government record-keeping. The 1960s and 1970s saw rapid advancements in data processing and computer technology, which enabled federal agencies to amass and store vast amounts of personal information. This technological shift raised concerns about privacy as agencies like the Social Security Administration, IRS, and the Department of Defense maintained extensive databases with little oversight or accountability. When it comes to surveillance state issues, there never seems to be any accountability or oversight, at least not until it is too late.
Well, you opened up with that example. All of a sudden, they realized, oh, these bad things are going on. They set up a commission. These people, I mean, did it amount to treason? Pretty bad. I don't know if it goes that far, but what was done about it? As far as I know, nobody went to jail. Even in the Watergate thing, finally, some people went to jail, but even that was all aired in a way that just eroded the faith that anyone had in their government or their country. And when I first got into the digital world, actually making a living, and I used to build websites, design databases, and everything else that went with it, there was a real concern about the HIPAA rules. All these doctors were very nervous and followed the rules, and we have to keep these records, and no one can read them, and we have to protect them. At about 98 or 99, all of a sudden, that just went away. And by the time we were in the 2000s, we had places like Google just raiding medical records with impunity. So it just goes to show you that if there was any idea of protecting things, it was never enforced at any level that mattered. But for some reason, before the late 90s, doctors and things were scared to get busted by HIPAA. But that's just doctors.
The Senate Select Committee to Study Governmental Operations with Respect to Intelligence Committees, commonly known as the Church Committee, was established on January 27, 1975, being chaired by Senator Frank Church of Idaho. It was formed in response to mounting evidence of intelligence agency abuses and conducted a comprehensive investigation into the activities of the NSA, CIA, FBI, and other agencies. It uncovered programs like Shamrock, Minaret, COINTELPRO, and Chaos. These revelations exposed widespread illegal surveillance, political repression, and violations of civil liberties, which led Senator Church to issue a stark warning about the NSA's potential to violate the privacy of American citizens if left unchecked. The committee's findings and recommendations were pivotal in exposing the surveillance state's scope and dangers, which prompted reforms, while highlighting its resilience and the challenges of imposing meaningful accountability. The committee's findings exposed just how much the normalization of mass surveillance had become in the United States. And by the way, isn't it convenient that this came about once the whole Vietnam conflict was over?
Exactly. You know, and in 2019, we get Shoshana Zuboff's book, and it's rightly titled, you know, we've got a whole economy built on surveillance now. So what you just said is underlined. Not only was it not enforced or nothing meaningful done, there was a whole economy being built on this. But in the modern era, do we think that any of these people in charge can do anything? Or what we see with things like Pizzagate, where they just blackmail people or put them in positions where they're going to be controlled or they'll never talk. Is that what's been going on? And I think it probably has. I don't think that it is possible for some of the things people want to see change. It is so deep, so entrenched. It would all just have to go away because you're never going to get all these organizations to come clean.
The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, is signed into law by President Jimmy Carter on October 25, 1978. FISA established the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISC, to oversee the issuance of warrants for surveillance conducted for foreign intelligence purposes, aiming to balance national security needs with the protection of privacy and civil liberties. It was enacted in response to the widespread intelligence abuses that had been uncovered by the previously mentioned Church Committee in 1975. FISA sought to impose judicial oversight on surveillance activities that had previously operated without legal constraints. However, its scope, exceptions, and implementation revealed the surveillance state's continuing resilience as it still preserved significant government power while creating a veneer of accountability. FISA allowed warrantless surveillance for up to 72 hours in emergencies, with retroactive FISC approval required, which was said to provide flexibility for urgent situations. The act did not cover surveillance that was conducted entirely outside of the U.S. or targeting non-U.S. persons abroad, which left significant gaps in oversight. It also preserved the president's inherent authority to conduct warrantless surveillance for national security in certain contexts, though this would be later debated in cases such as post-911 warrantless wiretapping.
And there you have it. You know, what does this look like? Probably exactly what it is. They were doing whatever they wanted, but they wanted to be able to do it in the open. So we have a thing like 9/11 and fear is used to basically just come out in the open. We get things like the Patriot Act. And has anyone ever looked up? Look it up, see how big it is. And then ask yourself, did anyone in the Senate or the House read that? Did anyone read that? And by the way, how did they have a document of that size ready to go so quickly after the event? And you begin to see what's going on, because as it stands now, I think the average American doesn't even have faith in its local police, because the news has been so busy trying to destabilize the way we think about even our local police that there's no faith in anything at this point. And, you know, at that point, things are just running amok.
Technology has changed significantly as we get into the 1980s and the dawn of the digital age. The corporation Axis Communications was established in the year 1984 in Lund, Sweden, by Michael Carlson, Martin Gren, and Keith Bloodworth. Initially, the company's focus was on developing protocol converters and network print servers, which aimed to connect printers to computer networks using what they called thin server technology. This was an early precursor to our modern concept of the Internet of Things. This mission reflected a broader trend of the 1980s of shifting from analog to digital systems and the growing connectivity of devices via networks like TCP/IP. While Axis did not immediately enter the surveillance market in its early years, the foundational work done in network technology laid the groundwork for its later innovations. In 1996, Axis would introduce the world's first network camera, the Axis NetEye 200, a device that transmitted live video over the internet, which would revolutionize video surveillance by making it remotely accessible and scalable. In 1984, the seeds of this transformation were already planted as the company's focus on open standards and network solutions foreshadowed its role in advancing surveillance technology. Over time, Axis would become a leader in IP-based cameras, including PTZ, which is pan, tilt, zoom, thermal, and AI-enhanced models that would be sold globally for security and monitoring purposes. The incoming digital revolution that was epitomized by companies like Axis would soon amplify the scale, efficiency, and reach of surveillance, which would align with George Orwell's vision in his book, 1984, of omnipresent monitoring.
I'm glad you included that. I mean, we forget things when we're talking in the way we are today. We forget things like George Orwell's book. How in the hell did Orwell write that? There had to have been something in the world that clued him in. We've showed that he's close to the inner circle. And that goes back. The reason 1984 is a date, it's marking 100 years from the founding to the day of a group. And it gets echoed in his book. But the point is if he could have wrote that book so far ago, I mean, you're talking 96 here when Axis is rolling out, I guess, what we're going to call the first webcam, right? That's basically what we're talking about.
Yes.
How many decades before that did they actually have the technology that they were just using among themselves? Like the airplanes that are supposedly 75 years ahead by the time we see them. Is this any different? But when we have the books that we have as one small slice to look back in time, how did they know to write these things? The seed's been there for a long, long time. I think the plan was there 100 years before 1984.
1985 marks the inception of the NSA's Fairview program, which was a secret initiative that established a partnership with AT&T, one of the United States' largest telecommunications companies, to access and collect global internet and telecom traffic. This program, which began 1 year after the famous breakup of the AT&T Ma Bell monopoly under antitrust regulations, represented a foundational step in the expansion of the modern surveillance state, leveraging corporate infrastructure to extend government reach into communications networks. While detailed public documentation from 1985 is quite limited due to the program's classified nature, subsequent revelations, particularly those from Edward Snowden's leaks in 2013, do provide some insight into its origins and significance. Unlike earlier programs, like Shamrock, which had been terminated in 1975 after Church Committee exposure, Fairview was a direct, ongoing collaboration with AT&T and would be described in Snowden documents as highly collaborative with AT&T, showing an extreme willingness to help. AT&T provided access to its facilities, including at least 17 internet hubs by the 2000s, though the program had begun with a smaller footprint in 1985. Fairview targeted phone, internet, and email data, primarily from foreign countries' citizens, by intercepting traffic at key U.S.-based nodes where international cables connected in with domestic networks. This would include transit traffic, which is communications between two foreign entities being routed through U.S. infrastructure due to AT&T's global reach. In 1985, Fairview was operating under a mix of legal frameworks, which included FISA for targeting specific U.S.-related communications and broader executive authority for foreign-to-foreign transit traffic. The lack of specific oversight for such transit collection allowed significant latitude, a precursor to later expansions under Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act in 2008. By 2011, the NSA was spending $188.9 million annually on Fairview, which was double its next largest program, Stormbrew. Stormbrew is another highly classified surveillance program operated by the NSA as part of its Special Source Operations Division, also designed to collect internet and telecommunications data
by partnering with major U.S. telecom companies, this one notably with Verizon. While its precise start date remains unclear due to its secretive nature, Stormbrew is believed to have been initiated in the mid to late 1980s, once again with significant details emerging from Edward Snowden's leaks in 2013.
So we don't even really get mainstream digital age until maybe the mid to late 90s, and these guys are in the early 80s putting together Stormbrew. What does a name like that tell you? But at the beginning of this paragraph, Jason, you show once again the problem with corporations. So here's a multi, I guess we could call it a multinational. If not, it's a massive corporation handling all the telephone traffic, among other things, and it's in bed with the NSA. And I would ask questions like, was Edward Snowden simply revelation of method? Was it? Or was it something else? Doesn't really matter at this point. We have the data. But if you go back to the so-called monopoly breakup of Ma Bell, at the time, that was a massive, massive deal. For some reason, the telephone company Ma Bell was okay to have their monopoly for, I guess, decades. But suddenly, one day, they had to break it up. Well, in this paragraph, you're seeing why. They break it up so they can begin to restructure and insert their surveillance systems. And it must, I don't even remember the decade. Do you remember the guy? I think it must have been somewhere in California, found he was a worker for one of the big telecoms, and he found a room he couldn't get into.
Oh.
And he's all, wait a minute. You remember?
Wait a point or two, and we will be covering that.
Oh, okay. Then I'll wait a point or two and we'll cover that. But this gets worse and worse. But when you look back in history, the Ma Bell monopoly breakup is touted as, see, the government protects you. They didn't allow a monopoly. Well, first of all, they allowed that monopoly for a hell of a long time. Secondarily, now we kind of realize they broke it up so that they could insert something even worse than a monopoly.
In 1986, the United States Congress passed the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, signed into law by President Ronald Reagan on October 21st, 1986. The ECPA updated the legal framework for wiretapping that had been established by the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act of 1968, extending protections to emerging digital communications technologies such as email, cellular phones, and computer data transmissions. Growing use of new technologies like email and cellular phones by businesses and individuals raised privacy concerns, prompting tech companies and civil liberties advocates to push for updated protections, though national security interests tempered these efforts. While the ECPA aimed to safeguard privacy in the face of technological advancements, once again, we see an act that retains significant loopholes, particularly for national security surveillance, which would allow government agencies, such as the NSA, to exploit ambiguities and continue expansive monitoring programs.
Well, another thing they do is look at the language they employed over the few bullet points we've covered up to this point on telecom. They do things like, well, we're just doing foreign traffic. And then they say, well, it's foreign to foreign traffic. It's laughable because if there's a foreign call, they're talking to someone in this country. So are you only collecting the income? I mean, it's all a bit ridiculous to the point where it's clear they're collecting it all.
The 1990s sees even more technological progression as the internet and related technologies become commonly used on a daily basis for many. The 1990s also sees a significant evolution in surveillance technology with the widespread adoption of multiplexing in closed-circuit television systems. Multiplexing enables the simultaneous monitoring and recording of multiple video feeds onto a single device, such as a VCR or later digital storage, which dramatically enhanced the efficiency, scalability, and capabilities of video surveillance. This technological advancement built on earlier CCTV deployments and the digital innovations of companies like the previously mentioned Axis Communications transformed surveillance from a labor-intensive, single-camera operation into a networked, multi-feed system capable of covering wide areas with fewer resources. By the mid-1990s, multiplexing became standard in CCTV systems worldwide. In the UK, which led global CCTV adoption, cities like London expanded camera networks dramatically, with over 10,000 cameras by the decade's end. This was often justified by high-profile incidents like the 1993 Bishopsgate bombing. In the United States,
multiplexing supported growth in retail, banking, and public space surveillance, with systems increasingly tied to police operations.
And fear is going to drive the bus every time when you lose your rights. Almost certainly that has become the main card that gets played. But I think it's safe to say, Jason, what's being laid down here is that the infrastructure for the coming open public digital systems was put in place long before anyone was even aware of what computers were going to be in the public anyhow.
The understanding of the technology absolutely seems to have been decades before any of us on the outside would have known.
You know, you go back and look at movies from the 70s like Day of the Condor, and they show how they were hacking phone lines and what had to be done. So if you draw a line there, it's within the next 10 years from when that movie or a movie like that was made that all the infrastructure switches over, Ma Bell is broken up, and all this stuff is being built for supposedly a coming digital system that doesn't even really exist yet.
And the last point for hour one, President Bill Clinton signs the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act into law on October 21st, 1998. It would become effective as of April 21st, 2000. COPPA was designed to regulate the collection, use, and disclosure of personal information from children under the age of 13 by operators of websites and online services. This reflected growing concerns about digital privacy as the internet became a mainstream tool for communication, commerce, and social interaction. While COPPA aimed to protect a vulnerable population in an increasingly data-driven world, its scope was actually rather narrow as it focused solely on minors and commercial entities. This left broader government and corporate surveillance practices largely unaddressed. Regardless, early internet commerce had revealed aggressive data collection practices, with companies amassing personal information, such as names, addresses, and browsing habits for marketing, often targeting vulnerable groups like children. High-profile cases, such as the Federal Trade Commission's 1998 investigation of GeoCities for deceptive data practices, underscored these risks. Parents, educators, and privacy advocates, including groups like the Center for Media Education, had lobbied for protections, citing studies that showed children's susceptibility to online exploitation and lack of understanding about data sharing.
So is it just me, or are you beginning to notice that October seems to be intimately tied with telecom in the way that we're talking about it? As a matter of fact, the 21st, we should actually, when we take the break, I'm going to look into that. But here we go. All these protections and all these things, we keep talking about them, and yet they run rampant. Everybody knows that all your cell phone communications are being taken. And if we go back to what we talked about in part one, things like Phalanx and Carnivore and the other ones we covered, there were countries accusing the U.S. of collecting every single electronic communication. And this is back in the 90s. So it just goes to show that I think what we're illustrating really well here is when they broke up Ma Bell from the old analog systems, they did so they could begin building out the infrastructure for the yet to come, in the public eye anyhow, digital systems that are ubiquitous now. But you have anything to add to this, Jason?
Well, what I want to point out to everyone is it's obvious, if you just look at this, that data was already becoming king all the way back in the 90s because everyone was getting on the internet at that point.
Well said. I mean, there it is, all the way back in the 90s. And, you know, we all know we lag behind what's actually current. We'll probably never know by how much, but data is king, and you're making a strong case. How long has data been king? I would suggest the 90s is easy to swallow. After all, Sun Microsystems, the executive officer, or one of the high ups, I think it's 99 or 2000, comes up and says, you guys have all these free cool tools, but there's no more privacy in the world. No one believed him. He was telling the truth. But that's it. I think we're going to take a short break and come back for hour two. Anything more you want to add?
Hour two is going to open with the infamous of infamous, 911, and just how many changes. Like, there weren't enough terrible things going on already before that. But 911, once again, huge changes for everything.
Without a doubt. In my mind, that day will always stand as the dividing line between bad people have to hide in the dark and bad people don't give a damn anymore and they do things in daylight. Anyhow, that is the end of hour one of episode 624. We're going to come back in about 5 minutes and do hour two. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is CROW777radio.com. Members get access to all the forums and comments sections. They can create top level ideas. They can stream the 2-hour film called Shoot the Moon anytime. That's all my older telescope work, the lunar waves, UFOs, chemtrails, and the first discovery of the second sun, which should come to be a big deal over the next 10 years, I would imagine. And they get access to all the stills I have shot with my Mobius huge solar telescope. With that, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. And I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.